Wow, it's kind of exciting. I'm here discussing rights-based approaches to health in the United States. Wow. Throughout my life, the entirety of my life, the United States has been uniquely hostile to accepting international legal standards and to providing universal health care. Today, I feel like we're not there, but I'm slowly coming home for the first time. And so, as one of many authors in the lead chapter of this book, I want to lay the groundwork for the chapters that are going to follow for me, discussing the international legal framework that many of the authors are seeking to apply. In doing so, I'll be addressing our chapter on rights-based approaches to underlying determinants of health through public health systems. Thinking about these underlying determinants of health, the economic, political, social systems that determine health status and have far greater impact on health than the provision of health care. And so we're all familiar with this mantra, health is a human right. Nobody in this room, I hope, would disagree with that. And yet we need to problematize this. Language is important in crafting human rights. So we need to ask, what do we mean when we say that health is a human right? When we talk about health under international law, it's not merely a right to health care, but it's a right to so much more. Are we talking about nutrition, air and water, immunization, housing, social security? When we talk about this broader concept of a right to health. When we talk about a human right, what does it mean to say that something is a human right? Are we thinking of these issues in terms of universality, equity, quality? And so rather than answering these questions, because I think they're answered in the book, and this is just a teaser, I just want to introduce you to the terms of the debate, lay out the normative frameworks for rights-based healthcare reform. And so in this presentation, I'm going to briefly lay out the framework of what we know about underlying determinants of health, thinking specifically about the state of underlying determinants of health and addressing them in the United States. From there, I'll move to the background, thinking about human rights and what they add to the health debate. From there, I'm going to discuss the findings in our chapter, thinking about how the human right to health has evolved to address underlying determinants of health through public health systems. And then finally, I'm briefly going to address our analysis, asking what a rights-based approach to health system reform means in the United States. And I apologize if I quickly bolt after my presentation. I have a 4 o'clock flight out of Denver, and the airport is a little bit farther than I thought it would be from here. And so we begin by thinking about what it means to talk about determinants of health. The Commission on Social Determinants of Health really introduces us to this idea of a cyclical relationship by which socioeconomic conditions are closely linked to the distribution of health. By emphasizing social inequalities rather than individual health services, this model examines underlying determinants of health in leading to detrimental health outcomes. I've looked here at the example of poverty as a fundamental underlying determinant of ill health, wherein poverty affects disparities in power, money, and resources, with these issues serving as mechanisms that affect health status. Thus, as seen through this model, it's become a maxim of public health, played out in many settings, that no matter the disease or from where it originates, it will inevitably descend the social gradient to become a disease of the poor. And so with this understanding of vulnerability as societally structured, public health systems can be seen to protect and promote the health of entire societies, employing multidisciplinary interventions to address the underlying structural causes of health and disease. And so in the United States, we seek to address this for the unemployed and the uninsured, creating social safety nets to protect people from absolute deprivation. But despite these social safety nets, we know that vast and pervasive inequalities persist, leading us to an understanding that healthcare is not enough. We see this in almost all developed countries, that even with universal systems of care, socioeconomic disparities persist in health systems. And so rather than medical care, we need to come to an understanding of the importance of a social safety net for underlying determinants of health. With these underlying determinants of health, power, money, resources, leading to good health outcomes. So we looked at the economic stimulus for health in most countries. Applied to the United States, usually a mistake when one does human rights analysis, we see that rather than cutting back on spending in a time of crisis, as the government is currently pursuing, there is a need from a human rights perspective, from an underlying determinants of health perspective, to stimulate the economy by investing in measures that seek to improve underlying determinants of health. And so in considering how human rights can frame these economic allocations for health, I want to discuss human rights for health and how these have evolved to address underlying determinants of health. And so when I discuss this, I'm going to be talking about human rights under international law for the public's health. And this is largely where the health and human rights movement lies, where these frameworks all come together. And so we know that international human rights discourse offers a powerful policy framework. That framing health disparities as rights violations offers international standards by which to frame government responsibilities and evaluate conduct, shifting the analysis from one of quality of care to one of social justice under law. And so to frame the intersection of human rights under international law for health, I need to begin by reiterating that human rights matter, that what is written into international law has an effect on the way that nations behave. And yet these human rights are not from God. They are things that people wrote. People wrote and put into law. These are ideas, they're norms, and as such, they evolve over time. And so we can look to the evolution of human rights in international law, looking at these laws to understand how the idea of a human right to health has changed over time. And I end by noting that the right to health itself has evolved over time to address issues of underlying determinants of health. And so our chapter chronicles the political dynamics of the evolution of a human right to health from the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the aftermath of the Second World War through to the present day. The part that I'll be discussing today chronicles the policy dynamics at four seminal moments in the history of the right to health. The expansive aspirational language of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the weakened legal obligations of the 1966 International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and then finally the reclaimed public health standards of the 1978 Declaration of Alma-Ata. With these standards of the Declaration of Alma-Ata codified by the UN in its 2000 General Comment 14 on the right to health. And so the codification of health as a human right begins, as with all human rights, in the context of the Second World War. In the aftermath of that war, understanding the health harms of the war and the depression that preceded it, these issues highlighted an imperative for what President Roosevelt called a freedom from want. Taking up this human rights mission on the heels of the creation of the United Nations and the World Health Organization, Eleanor Roosevelt, the second half of America's first power couple, working through the United Nations to declare a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, enacting through it a right to health by which everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. Note here the language of a standard of living adequate for health. At the time, there was widespread agreement that a right to health included both the provision of necessary medical care and underlying determinants of health, explicitly including language on food, clothing, housing, and necessary social services. But with states subsequently avoiding the right to health at the height of the Cold War, the UN General Assembly would summarily weaken proposals for a right to health in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, eliminating the definition of complete health and reference to social well-being that had existed in previous drafts, and furthering ambiguity in the language of a right to health, weakening the right to health through these ambiguities. The General Assembly removed language on underlying determinants of health, removing language on nutrition, housing, sanitation, recreation, economic and working conditions, and leaving only the vagueness of what became known as industrial and environmental hygiene. But as ideas of health changed in the 1960s, so too did support for human rights to promote the public's health. In the aftermath of the war, discourses on health had veered away from a focus on public health and toward curative medicine. Yet in the intervening years, public health showed far greater promise in preventing disease and promoting health, shifting health discourse back toward underlying determinants of health through primary healthcare systems. Primary healthcare referring to healthcare in addition to the underlying social, political, and economic determinants of the public's health. And so with health framed as a widespread social imperative rather than a limited medical challenge, human rights would be seen as instrumental in the realization of health. And so by 1978, the time had come to put this idea of underlying determinants of health into international law. And so in doing so, states came together in the International Conference on Primary Healthcare to revise a rights-based approach to underlying determinants of health in Alma-Ata, in what's now Kazakhstan. And that's, Ted Kenny was a pretty man once upon a time. And so reaffirming the language of complete health, Article 1 of the resulting Declaration of Alma-Ata outlines that health, which is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity, is a fundamental human right that requires the action of many other social and economic sectors in addition to the health sector. By re-engaging this idea of underlying determinants of health and the right to health, this Declaration of Alma-Ata created a model for national policies to develop primary health care, declaring these public health systems to be human rights that would have priority over other goals, and in so doing would present a unifying framework for encapsulating underlying determinants of health in the human right to health. And so given this evolution in the right to health, following the roller coaster from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights through the Declaration of Alma-Ata and down through the Washington Consensus, General Comment 14 would be created by the UN's Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. In seeking to reinterpret the international covenants in an expansive way to codify the obligations of the Declaration of Alma-Ata, General Comment 14 finds that obligations for public health exist within the individual right to health, interpreting the right to health to note that it includes not only timely and appropriate health care, but also underlying determinants of health, and then listing those underlying determinants of health with great specificity. And so prescribing a broad and inclusive conception on the content of the right to health, General Comment 14 delineates institutional characteristics of a rights-based system for the public health, including availability, that there should be sufficient facilities and services for underlying determinants of health, that there be accessibility, both physical and economic accessibility of those services, that they be acceptable, that they be designed to improve health status, and finally, that they be of sufficient quality, that they be both scientifically and medically appropriate, that they be evidence-based. And so analyzing the application of this evolving right to health for health system reform, my co-authors and I find that the development of international law has affirmed a right to health that extends well beyond healthcare to include underlying determinants of health. And so this isn't simply a package of reforms to the medical system. In fact, it's wrong to think of a right to health as a package of services, even if that package extends beyond medical care. That when we talk about a rights-based approach to health systems, we're talking about a decision-making framework that shall be incorporated into the practice of all government agencies that make up the public health system. And so in crafting a public health approach to healthcare reform, the four qualities that we addressed from General Comment 14, availability, accessibility, acceptability, and quality, these should be seen as interrelated and interdependent in health system reform, creating availability in the pursuit of universality, alleviating underlying determinants of health at the societal level, these underlying determinants that prevent equitable health outcomes among social groups, that we try to achieve accessibility in creating state responsibility for guaranteeing public goods and for regulating the private sector where it does not provide those public goods directly, that such systems be acceptable in moving from an individual to a collective analysis. These systems shall focus on the efficient prevention interventions that have so long been left out of healthcare reform. And finally, that this be of sufficient quality, that it be evidence-based, examining at the population level public health indicators for the realization of underlying determinants of health. So we began by focusing on the idea of understanding what it means to say that health is a human right, trying to understand what it means to define health, what it means to define human right. I want to end by focusing on the word we left out, is. Health is a human right. Now is the time to deal with these issues. With 60 years having passed since the creation of the global health and human rights system, with the continuous evolution of concepts for a right to health, building towards support for underlying determinants of health through public health systems. At the end of this 60 years, public health is engaging with primary health care again, with public health systems again. The just released World Health Report, primary health care now more than ever, notes striking inequities within and between countries in health outcomes, in access to care, and it calls for a return to an emphasis on underlying determinants of health. This is a unique opportunity to discuss underlying determinants of health in the US and in countries throughout the world. In doing so, the discourse on human rights can reconfigure government responsibility, shifting the contours of the health policy debate and creating legal accountability for achieving the highest attainable standard of health. So I look forward to your participation in this challenge, and I think this book is the first step in moving toward that goal. Thank you very much.